This is Renegade Broadcasting. Alrighty, buddy. Happy Friday. Well, what do you know? This is the, let's see. Wow, the 38th anniversary of my baptism. June 3rd, 1978. That date is firmly etched in my mind. Yes, 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 yes. I was a little 12-year-old dupe. I remember the day well. It was in a lake, actually. We're at a summer camp. And, I thought it was such a great thing, you know. The very next day, it was a Saturday. The very next day, I remember my grandfather came over. He was working out in the garden. And, I was trying to help him. Didn't know what I was doing. But anyway, I stepped forward to help push some squash seeds into the ground. And I stepped back and stepped on one of the mounds that he had made, you know. And so he got mad. He snapped at me. And so I remember saying, "Jesus Christ, Gramps, I didn't do it on purpose." And all of a sudden it hit me what I had done. I took the Lord's name in vain. Oh, let me tell you guys, that was a bitter moment. I thought I was going to hell. I went from dancing on the clouds in my glory because I was baptized the day before. I was a new person now. You know, Paul says, old things are passed away. All things are become new. Why, I'm filled with the Holy Spirit. And now, all of a sudden, scarcely a day later, I did a big, bad no-no. Not even thinking about it. You know, it just slipped out. I took the Lord's name in vain. Do you see what enslavement that bullshit is? Do you see what it does to you? And now the doubts, the horror. You start wondering, how could I be filled with the Holy Spirit? If I did that, it doesn't matter that I slipped up and didn't intend to say that. I said it. Isn't God supposed to prevent me from that? The fact that he didn't. Nothing must have happened yesterday. Well, nothing did happen yesterday, you dumbass. Oh, the dupes that gets sucked into that. And then when things like that happen, they think their whole world has collapsed. God damn it. The fact that you do slip up and do things like that should tell you, Bible dupes, there's no such thing as the Holy Spirit. Why, I've never seen it in any Bible dupes I've ever known, except my mother and a couple other exceptions that I can count in the fingers of one hand. That's it. But that's not because there's a Holy Spirit. That's because there just so happens by rare chance luck to be a few decent ones among them. And there are far more decent ones outside their ranks, as it turns out, that don't believe in that fairy tale, that happen to be decent people. because that's just who they are. There's your best disproof of religion right there. You don't have to examine all the fraudulence of that goddamn so-called holy book. Just look at how many non-Bible dupes are decent and how many Bible dupes are indecent. That should tell you something right there, shouldn't it? Anyway, but yes, today marks the day of my 38th baptismal anniversary. So let's all open our hymnals to page 572. Jesus Christ, man. Oh, the precious memories. Anyway, I wasn't even intending to talk about that. I just happened to look at the date, the time and the date here on my clock, computer clock. And it hit me, oh yeah, June 3rd, what do you know? Anyway, picking up where we left off yesterday, I actually only have like another page or two left of the Mars discussion. Actually, we're going to end off talking about Venus. Just like Mars, we read yesterday from ancient sources that it appears that Mars's catastrophe was witnessed and recorded, so it appears with Venus. The Venus cataclysm must have been witnessed and handed down to posterity. The Iliad states that Pallas Athene, which was their name for Venus, quote, darted down to Earth a gleaming star with sparks springing from it. They must have witnessed something streaming off of Venus, one of the great impacts that struck it, spewing debris into space, and it must have looked like a piece of it struck the Earth. Well, that makes sense. You know, Venus is always near the horizon because its orbit is internal to ours, just like Mercury, even closer to the horizon, usually. Anyway, so, you know, one of these streaming pieces of debris coming off of its surface must have looked like it was streaming down to Earth, because Venus, again, is so close to the horizon. It must have looked like it was coming off of Venus and striking the Earth. This had to be, an eyewitness account, most likely from that period. It could have been after that too, but, you know, judging from the description, if the impact was big enough to have been witnessed from Earth, it had to be during this so-called, you know, great bombardment period, just like the Martian catastrophe. It said it was pierced in its belly, and it put on quite a display. Anyway, darted down toward the Earth because of the flying sparks that were seen shooting out from it. Seeing that Venus never strays, far from the horizon, again, either at dawn or dusk, any sparks shooting from it when it was impacted would have indeed looked like they were shooting down to the Earth, as I said. By comparison, the Persian Mithra, or Venus, is said to have descended from the heavens and, quote, let a stream of fire flow toward the Earth. Here, this ancient legend is saying the same thing, and that it, quote, filled our world with its devouring heat. Well, that makes sense, because at the time that they saw, or at least shortly thereafter, that they saw Venus being struck, the Earth itself met a similar fate. The Earth itself was struck with debris. At some point, I'll probably repeat that whole series I did on the Earth's catastrophe. Or if you want, just request the notes, I can send them to you. But I cite numerous, very detailed references from cultures around the world that describe the hell that was unleashed on Earth at this same time. how great chasms were formed. The very ground beneath our feet opened up. A tremendous heat was unleashed. The sky was ablaze. Stars were seen falling in every direction. Yeah. Volcanoes were going off. And then it says, shortly after, the earth fell into a deep freeze. Wow, man. These recollections record a massive global scale. Cataclysm that can't be compared with anything else that's been seen in Earth's history. Isn't it amazing how the great learned think tanks ignore completely all of these ancient records? And why? Oh, because the great learned minds of today know so much more than people who lived thousands of years ago who witnessed these things, of course. That's why. And they're so much more advanced than they were. Anyway. The planet Venus was seen as the cause of Earth's catastrophe by the ancient inhabitants of the Middle East, ancient inhabitants, at least in one point in their history. Or perhaps they only saw it as contributing thereto. In any case, they made a connection between the devastation of Venus and the devastation of Earth. It seemed to them like Venus, though, was responsible, because Venus being closer to the horizon and debris shooting off its surface, looking like it was shooting toward the horizon. You didn't see that with Mars. Mars must have been seen overhead being attacked, right? But when Venus was attacked, some of its debris was seen looking like it was coming toward Earth. And then shortly after that time, Earth was struck. So you can see why they thought Venus was attacking Earth. So they blamed it for the Earth's catastrophe. Very interesting. In any case, the Babylonian Psalms record Ishtar, or again, Venus, as saying, by causing the heavens to tremble and the earth to quake, by the gleam which lightens in the sky, by the blazing fire which rains upon the hostile land, I am Ishtar. Ishtar am I, by the light that arises in heaven. Ishtar, the queen of heaven, am I, the light that arises in heaven. So there you go, the Babylonians. We're on to this as well. They, you know, notice all these various cultures, guys, all depicting the same thing. Anyway, this hymn goes on to say, I am Ishtar, on high I journey. The heavens I cause to quake, the earth I cause to shake. That is my fame. So Venus, was known for having caused the earth to shake, or at least that's the way it was perceived by them. In ancient India, Venus was referred to in the Vedas as being, quote, like a bull that hurled fire upon earth and heaven, precisely paralleling the above accounts. So in India, faraway India, they were saying the same thing. This is more than likely the origin of the cow and bull being viewed as sacred by the Hindus. Why was Venus called a bull? Because when in crescent phase, it looks like two bull horns. And of course, you can't see that crescent phase with the naked eye. You need a telescope, which of course, obviously, they had. We know the Assyrians had lenses, as I mentioned the other day. Anyway, the Babylonian Ishtar and the Egyptian Isis, which was that culture's name for Venus, were depicted as having two horns as well. So those cultures also referred to Venus or associated Venus with a bull. So Venus was probably in crescent phase and thus close to Earth and much brighter in the sky when it was struck at the time of its catastrophe. So it would have been, you know, showed up better in a telescope. It would have showed up better with the naked eye. Or actually, come to think of it, no, in crescent phase. Well, no. In crescent phase, it would have been closer to the Earth. Anyway. Let's see. That's pretty much it, I guess. That covers the bases. I'm just making sure. Yeah, a lot of this is just redundant, the last final couple points here. Anyway, pretty fascinating stuff. When you look, once again, at the cumulative physical as well as legendary evidence, all ancient legends from around the world, by the way, the Maya, the Olmecs in the Americas put a heavy emphasis on Venus. The Anasazi, I almost said Ashkenazi. Don't mix those two up. The Anasazi, also put a heavy emphasis on Venus. Very interesting. And, of course, native cultures, many of them, all of them pretty much, have their own versions of catastrophic stories, too, which often involve Venus as having played a role. My God, man, you just can't ignore this stuff. But they do. Of course there's hyperbole, exaggerations in these stories. All these ancient legends do. That's how they passed them on to their kids. They pumped them up with hyperbole, you know, to make them more interesting. My grandfather used to do that. I used to love the stories he told me. Probably only 50% true, but I didn't care. I suspected as a kid he was exaggerating. But they were so fun to listen to. Tell me the, you know, his old hunting stories and fishing adventures, you know, whatever. That's something we do in modern times. A lot of people like to tell Bible stories. Those are filled with outrageous, scandalous, ridiculous, nonsensical exaggerations. Balaam and his talking donkey. Can you believe that Bible dupes actually accept that as a real story? Jesus Christ, there's no hope. There's no goddamn hope, man. No hope for these people. They're gone, folks. They're gone. God damn it all. Most of them. I wouldn't say don't waste your time at all. Make an attempt, but if you can clearly see that you're getting the lights are on, but no one's home response, move the frig on. Don't waste your time. Most of them are just hopeless cases. They're frickin' gone. God damn it. Cut my hair and I'll lose my superhuman strength. The Samson BS. You know, on and on it goes. God damn it. It's so ridiculous. A guy who spends 3 days in the belly of a big fishy and lives to talk about it. Oh, yeah. And the ultimate trump card excuse they'll give is, well, God can do anything. Really? He can have a guy live in a belly of a fish for 3 days, but he can't solve the problem of the tribe and their raping and pillaging of the planet shenanigans. That's real good. That's a good story. How inspiring. That makes me want to join your cult. Where do I sign up? I too want to worship a god like that. Yes, yes. Thousands of years ago, he can make a man survive 3 days in the belly of a big fishy. but he can't solve the massive, monumental, death-inducing problems that curse our world today. Praise the Lord. Yes, I believe in miracles. God damn it all. Anyway, so that completes our discussion of the Martian catastrophe and the Venus catastrophe, too, for that matter. Well, it was any number of directions I was planning on going after this. I guess I'll tackle this one next. This is another interesting topic. I actually just put these notes together recently. I dealt with this topic, on occasion in the past. When I talked about catastrophism, I mentioned this factor in passing, and I do cover it briefly in my book, but I never went into it in any significant detail. Actually, I got the idea to do a whole show on this topic from a listener last week in an email. He asked me, have you ever covered, ever done a show on, you know, all the underwater ruins that have been found, you know, around the world, offshore, sometimes far offshore, very deep under ocean water. And I'm like, actually, no, I haven't done a whole show on it. I've touched on it, but I thought, yeah, actually, it'd be good to do a whole show on that, because when I've touched on in the past, I only mentioned a few of the more common examples, but there are many. In fact, in these notes, I'm not exhaustive. I don't cover all of them, more than what I've mentioned before. But, you know, there's got to be at least 100, if not more, examples of this all over the world, guys, of underwater, in some cases, entire cities, miles and miles offshore, and, you know, scores, in some cases, hundreds of feet beneath the ocean surface. So far out into deep sea that modern scientists agree that, you know, the ocean level was not that low for at least 10,000 years. Most of these ruins we're going to be looking at, scientists agree those areas have not been dry land since at least 10,000 years ago, which is interesting because that takes us back to about the time that most catastrophists believe this global catastrophe occurred. I do want to stress, though, that I do not believe, like a lot of catastrophists do, I do not believe that any of these ruins represent pre-flood civilization. No, not at all. I would argue that that's pretty much impossible. The flood catastrophe was of such a devastating, destructive nature that pre-flood civilizations, almost without exception, were completely destroyed. Nothing was left of them. You wouldn't have stones still be standing in place after that catastrophe. The entire surface of the earth was completely reworked. Nothing was left intact. Everything was upheaved, buried deep in the earth. Like I said, a lot of the earth's resources were buried deep. It took a long time for man to rebuild civilization and to begin to explore and, you know, to start mining to find where a lot of its resources were buried. Everything was all reworked, completely changed. Therefore, these ruins that can be seen, you know, deep underwater around the globe must represent early post-flood settlements that were built in areas that have since been inundated with deep ocean water because a lot of the waters from the flood catastrophe had not subsided yet, had not washed off of the continents and raised the ocean, raised sea level to its current position. That's why they were inundated. Anyway, but nevertheless, these ruins found in deep ocean water clearly reveal that civilization dates back much longer than what the think tank schmucks would have us believe. They want us to believe that ancient civilizations can only be traced back roughly 5, at the most 6,000 years. Beyond that, man was primitive, living in caves, incapable of building civilizations. But these ruins alone tell us that that's not true. There have been some ruins found on dry land, too, that have been dated before that time, forcing them to have to rethink. Do you see how, when you don't let yourself be led, or should I say misled, by these mental midgets, you don't have to rethink. You don't have to tenaciously and desperately try to cling to your old ideas. And when new findings come along, oh, no, it can't be. You don't have to do that because you're not hemmed in. You're not locked in by their confining, constricting. Guys, it's the same as religion. Isn't it interesting that scientists argue with religionists all the time, and yet they're as equally and sometimes even more obnoxiously dogmatic than they are? I say screw them both. They're both full of shit on opposite ends of the shit stick, but still full of shit nonetheless. You have to reject all the bullshit, all of what officialdom has handed us, or at least hold it in high suspicion. Be willing, ready, willing, and able to question it, to trash it at any given moment as new light comes along. So anyway, with all that said, yeah, let's get into this discussion. Very, very interesting. Around the world, there are many ancient ruins found off the coast in deep ocean waters, areas, again, that are believed to have been dry land. Thousands of years ago. At least 10,000 years. Were these ruins inhabited, we must ask, by people who lived, shortly after the flood? Like I said, I'll argue there's no way they're pre-flood. Most books that you read, Graham Hancock, for example, he has a whole book on this subject. Very fascinating, very good book. However, his premise is that, he believes there was a global catastrophe, a global flood caused by impacting debris. Great, all right, three cheers. But he believes that these underwater ruins are pre-flood. Guys, no way. If you accept a global flood catastrophe, if you realize the scope and the magnitude of the thing, there's no way those ruins would have been left unscathed. All right, anyway, short break, guys. You guys are great, thank you.
Presented, as history is written by the victors. So all we really hear about is the mass murder of a thoroughly debunked 6 million. We are never told about the suffering of the German people during that so-called good war. And if it is brought up, we are told that those Nazis deserved it. Firebombed, raped, tortured, slaughtered in the most sickening ways imaginable. But the world has been left in the dark about these atrocities. Until now. Hellstorm is setting the record straight. Watch the documentary that has shaken the world. Available for free at hellstormdocumentary.com.
Guys, welcome back. I just got a text from my buddy Graham Hart. I saw this last night. I forgot to mention it this morning. He just reminded me. Now the official report has finally come out now. The toxicology reports. By the way, my mother's visiting nurse. I was talking with her the other day, and I asked her if it's normal to take weeks or months on end for tests like that to come back. She said, actually, yeah. She said a blood test, just a regular blood test, you know, if they're trying to check for your blood serum, cholesterol level, you know, whatever, that can happen. You know, those results can come back within a day or two. But toxicology reports, she said, much more detailed, involving, she says that, you know, that can take weeks or even months. So, you know, that's not a suspicious thing there. But what is suspicious, of course, is the fact that they cremated the guy. While there were suspicions about his death, how can you cremate someone's remains when there's any hint of suspicion? God damn son of a.
But anyways, we can rest assured now. Go back to sleep. Nothing to worry about here. The toxicology reports confirm that he died from an overdose of painkillers. Oh, wow, that just takes care of it right there.
Oh, whatever, man. Anyway, back to our discussion here. What the hell? Well, that's weird. Not sure how that happened. I clicked on Graham Hart's name to get his text. Now I went to click back on Studio One, and I don't see the regular screen showing up. That's weird. I've never seen that before. Anyway, who knows? I'm a Skype novice. I only use Skype to do the show. I really don't understand this program. And, you know, it wouldn't matter anyway, even if I familiarized myself so I was more proficient with it. They update the thing so goddamn often and change everything around. I can't stand when they do that. You buy a word processor program, you get familiar with navigating your way around the thing, you learn all of the hotkey functions so you don't have to keep using the drop down menu thing, right? You can whip your way through it very quick just by hitting alt this, alt that, you know, blah blah blah. Then they come out with a new version and none of the hotkey functions work the same way they did with the previous version, even though it's the same company, the same exact name of the word processor. Can you freaking believe? Look, you want to update the thing, add a few more bells and whistles, fine. But why the hell do you change the hotkey commands? God damn them to hell. That is so freaking annoying. I don't even want their updates when they do that horse shit. They did an upgrade on the Kindle recently. Didn't even ask permission. They did it automatic. I had the thing in sleep mode, so it did it overnight one day. The next morning, I go to turn it on. I'm like, what the hell's this? Jesus Christ. I couldn't find anything. I'm like, where the hell are my books? It took me the longest time to figure out where anything was. I called up Amazon. I was furious. You know, why don't you ask permission? I don't want this update. How do I undo it? You know what she said? Oh, well, you can do that, but it will take 3 days. You have to leave it on, plugged in. It'll take 3 days to put the old software back. What the hell kind of crap is that? You know, that's literally like a thief breaking into your house, vandalizing your house, and getting away with it. That's what they're doing when they do this stuff. They're vandalizing your property. That is one of my big pet peeves. I can't stand people messing with my stuff. I know where everything is. And when you don't see very good to begin with, you can't afford to have people messing with your stuff and moving it around. It frigs you up. Oh, God damn it, that annoys me. Anyway, all right, enough of that. This is Pet Peeves Day. Call in if you got any pet peeves you want to share. I got a list a million miles long. Anyway, back to our discussion here. Let's begin with India, looking at some offshore ruins there. By the way, there's more than what I even cover here. I was reading an article the other day. There's several more that have been discovered recently. When the tsunami, Indian Ocean tsunami of 2004 struck, the man-made Indian tsunami of 2004, some new ruins were discovered at that time. The tsunami caused ocean waters to recede quite a bit in the wake of the thing, in some areas anyway. And sure enough, there were some ruins sticking out in the sand that had, you know, that weren't known before. Very interesting. Anyway, several miles off of the southeast coast of India, submerged at a depth of 69 feet in the Bay of Bengal, an ancient man-made structure was discovered on the ocean floor in the early 1990s. It's made in the shape of a huge horseshoe, and it measures about 255 feet in length, with walls that are about 3 feet thick and 6 feet high. Imagine that, guys. 69 feet, 70 feet of water. That's pretty damn deep. Do understand, in order to be 69 feet, almost 70 feet underwater, that means the ocean, you know, the entire sea level had to have been raised that much. Not just locally around India. We're talking, you know, the whole thing. It goes, connects right out to the Pacific Ocean, of course. So, you know, pretty much on a global scale. The only other exception would be if the landmass that these ruins are on somehow sank. But there isn't any evidence of that. Scientists don't believe that that's why they're underwater. They believe, in fact, that the ocean level has raised. And they don't believe the ocean level was that low for at least the past 10,000 years. So these are extremely ancient ruins. There are some occasions where land masses do raise, but usually what's happening, unless there's some, you know, colossal earthquake, there's no sign, though, of that area having been raised under such circumstances. The other exception, of course, would be a volcanic eruption. That happens all the time, you know, in the Pacific, for example. No island one day, and the next day, boom, an island appears because of a volcanic eruption. That's what the Hawaiian Islands are, of course. But other than that, you don't just have huge swaths of land suddenly raising up above sea level, you know, or dropping below sea level. You know, other than that, the only way that can happen is if the ocean levels themselves rise. And so when you see sunken ruins like this, in order for the, you know, the level of ocean water to have raised to that height, the level of ocean water had to raise on a global scale. You can't just say, oh, well, the local Indian Ocean level raised. No, it had to raise around the world. So we are indeed dealing here with something very ancient, far more ancient than, you know, what they want us to believe. Civilization goes back a lot further. And guys, I'll argue, civilization goes back a lot further than even 10,000 years. Advanced civilization. The only reason why we don't see the remains thereof is because they were completely destroyed by this catastrophe. If that hadn't happened, we would be finding ruins that go back long before 10,000 years ago. You see what you miss out on because you're not informed of things like this. They just can't come around to admitting that they've been wrong. Like I said, there's been some admission, you know, oh, yeah, we agree. There were some catastrophes. They, you know, they agree that that's what wiped out the dinosaurs. Yep, there must have been. But, you know, not on the colossal scale that would be required. They admit that, yeah, we have found the tertiary Cretaceous clay boundary layer containing iridium, you know, all over the world in the KT boundary. And so we know that there must have been a big asteroid that hit the Earth, and so that must have wiped out the dinosaurs. But it's just so goddamn ridiculous, guys, that they, you know, they can't see that these layers were laid down in an instant and not over multiplied millions of years. Like I said, guys, polystrat fossils absolutely destroy that notion, completely destroy it. There's other evidences that do that too, but just the polystrat fossils alone, petrified tree trunks standing perpendicular, straight up in these horizontal layers of silt. There's no way they could have taken millions of years to accumulate when you have tree trunks standing straight up in them. Obviously, those layers were laid down very quickly, buried these tree trunks, and the whole thing, the tree trunk and the silt layers, all became petrified all at once because they were buried deep under the earth. They were baked like clay by the overlying layers of debris that created pressure and heat. Bake them like clay and harden them to stone in a short time. That's another important point to bring out. I mentioned this when I talked about catastrophism years ago. It does not require millions of years to petrify something. Petrification can take place in a very short period of time when the conditions are right. Under ordinary circumstances, yeah, petrification does not take place at all. You can bury a bone in your backyard today or have Rover do it and come back, you know, 500 years from now. If that bone is still there, it won't be petrified. It'll have turned, you know, a dark color because of the surrounding soil. A lot of the surrounding soil will have leached into that bone from the centuries of rain. Sure, it'll be darkened, discolored, but it'll still be bone. It won't be petrified. And why? Because it requires a process known as liquefaction to bring about petrification. Liquefaction is a condition where the soil that encases a bone or any other organic material, the soil is so completely inundated with water that it's almost in liquid form, liquid mud. It's not just wet sand or dirt. It is saturated. It's swimming with water. And because of that, the water, so completely impregnated with dissolved minerals, seeps into every square micromillimeter of that, you know, that organic material. Down to the cellular level, it so completely saturates it that it literally petrifies it. When you add to that the weight of overlying debris, tremendous weight that causes heat and tremendous pressure, yeah, it cooks it. It bakes the mineral content of the mud right into the material. Ultimately, all of the organic material winds up decaying and dissolving away, but the minerals that have completely inundated that organic material replace it so that you have an exact mineral replica of the original organic structure. In some areas, petrification is done so well that you can look under a microscope and see the original cell structures, even though the actual organic materials have long since decomposed. You know, they're long gone. But the thing looks like it's still alive. You can see the cells of the damn thing. Some fish in Brazil have been so well preserved that the scales are still on the damn fish. You can cut them open and see what they had for dinner, their last meal. Everything is perfectly preserved right down to the last cell. It's amazing. Dinosaurs have been found preserved in that way. There have been some mummified, petrified dinosaurs that have been found. Of course, I also mentioned, and this is a big problem for the mental midget scientists of today, and most of them are mental midgets. There have been, you know, I think the first one was found in, I believe, Montana. And it was thought that that was some freak anomaly. But since then, over the past 20 years or so, similar finds now have been made up in Alaska, over in New Mexico, and I believe a few other places as well. I don't know about outside the United States. I don't think so. These finds have only been made in the U.S. But they have found dinosaur bones, folks, in several different locations now, that upon breaking them open, there's still soft, malleable organic materials inside the marrow. Tissue that you can pull on with a tweezer and it snaps back. It's red in color. And under the microscope, you can see blood vessels and blood cells. Mainstream scientists, of course, ignore this, run away from it like the plague. They don't talk about it. Oh, there's been a couple articles here and there, but that's it. This should have been groundbreaking news on the cover of every scientific journal. Do you realize that it is absolutely impossible to have organic tissues like that survive for millions and millions of years? It's not possible. It's only possible if these fossil materials are only in the thousands of years old. And again, I'm not arguing that the Earth is only goddamn 6,000 years old. The flood catastrophe itself was at least 10 or 11,000 years ago. I'm simply saying that their dating methods are colossally out of whack. Their time scales are colossally out of whack. When I talked about catastrophism, one of the things I discussed was ancient recollections and ancient representations in artifacts, you know, various artworks from the ancient world of what could only be described as dinosaurs. Maybe I should repeat that show. Drop me an email if you want to hear that, you know, by popular demand. Maybe I'll repeat that show. I do a whole show just talking about ancient artworks depicting obvious dinosaurs. In the ancient ruins of Nan Madal, for example, you have a freaking stegosaurus on one of the temple walls there. It's a stegosaurus. It looks like something right out of a modern textbook. And that was only built about 1,000 years ago. Were stegosauruses in existence on this specific island as recently as 10,000 years ago? Why not? Why not?
Just because mainstream scientists say, no, that's not possible?
They said it wasn't possible for ginkgos to be around up until 1940 when they were, mid-1940s, whatever. They
said that about the coelacanth. The coelacanth was only known in the fossil record. They died out millions of years ago.
Nope. Fishermen caught some in 1930 off the coast of Madagascar. These stale, stagnant paradigms, guys, we've got to let go of them. Just like Einsteinian physics. Oh, Jesus Christ, let it go. And it's not even Einsteinian. It's Poincarian. The French scientist he plagiarized. Anyway. Jeez, I'm really getting off the track today. Back to our notes here. As I said, these ruins off the coast of India are found to be in a horseshoe shape. They measure 255 feet in length, and the walls are about 3 feet thick and 6 feet high. Because some other structures have been found much closer to the shore at depths of only 6 feet, which date to the 3rd century BC, it's believed by most archaeologists that this horseshoe structure also dates to this time. But again, guys, it's ridiculous. It's much further out, and it's in much deeper waters. And the ruins don't even match those found closer in that obviously date to a much earlier, much later time. Absolutely ridiculous. But they do this because they have to. It doesn't fit the paradigm, so we just have to explain it away. Yeah, that's fine. There, everything's nice and tidy now. Nothing's out of place here. So pathetic, so disgusting. Quite clearly, this ancient horseshoe structure, guys, because it's buried at a depth that's believed not have been dry land since at least 10,000 years ago, obviously, we're dealing with, you know, a much older set of ruins here. Anyway, interestingly, southern India has Atlantis-type legends of an ancient land called Kumari Kandam, which once existed as a continent in the Indian Ocean. It's said that this continent sank, at least from their perception, which could also be understood to mean that it was simply inundated as the ocean level rose. But nevertheless, they talk about a continent that sank. There was a continent there, and it was inhabited, and now we see remains of it. Very interesting. Anyway, this ancient continent housed, says the legend, an advanced civilization, not just a civilization, an advanced one. Just like, you know, the Greeks with their Atlantis legend. You know, I'd argue there's some truth to it, but all we're dealing with there is an advanced, one of many advanced civilizations that existed prior to the flood catastrophe. That's the Greek version of the Egyptian Zep-Tepi that talks about a paradise that existed long before this great global scale flood catastrophe. Anyway, let's move on to Japan. Lots of ancient ruins found off the coast of Japan. One of the most amazing underwater mysteries in the world is the Yonaguni megalithic structure. It was first discovered in 1985 by Kahachiro Arataki, a professor at the University of the Ryukyus, while looking for schooling hammerhead sharks in the area. He happened to stumble upon this. Since then, these ruins have been studied by many researchers around the world. Most scientists, though, as you might guess, say, oh, it's a natural formation. Do you know how many times they say that? Over and over and over again, ruins have been discovered, and each time they write them off.
Natural formation.
They have to say that because it doesn't fit with their paradigm. It's like what they do when you find fossil human footprints in, you know, strata that dates back to
the time of the dinosaurs.
They've actually found whole series of human tracks crossing over dinosaur tracks.
No, that's not, they're not human. No, that's something else.
Oh, really? Guys, if you ever seen these prints, they're as goddamn human as you can get. All right, short break, right back.
Feminization of men has been a big part of the Semitic takeover of the European people.
Mindless goddamn drone that can buy into this. Do you know how many billions?
Trump's call on Monday to halt the entrance of Muslims to the U.S. is driving online chatter among white supremacists and is likely...
They're so inundated with the pop culture, and I think people like... us are trying to kind of remove ourselves from that.
Renegade Broadcasting.
Yeah. This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, welcome back. Anyway, I was going to make a point before the break. My mind just got distracted and I forgot what it was. I was talking about liquefaction earlier. Liquefaction is also the explanation as to why we see in the fossil record around the world the same types of groupings of fossil remains. Scientists want us to think that, oh, that represents evolution. The simpler life forms were at, you know, the lower depths, and the more complex ones as you go higher up the ladder. Well, actually, that's not even true, because in the earliest Cambrian layers, the lowest layers, we find trilobites. Trilobites have, you know, had very advanced multi-lensed eyes, ladies and gentlemen. That's not a primitive development. That's a very advanced one in the very lowest layers. But the point is, the arrangement of organic materials that we see in the fossil record has nothing to do with advancement from simpler to more advanced. It has to do with the buoyancy of these organic materials having arranged themselves in these layers, these liquefaction layers that acted like liquid water, so completely inundated with the mud, was so saturated with water that it flowed like a liquid. And so the organic materials floated. Some sank, some rose closer to the top. They arranged themselves according to their buoyancies in this liquefaction material. That's why they're arranged in the order that they're in. God damn it all. Anyway, coming back to the Japanese Yonaguni finds. The 300-foot-long structure is situated 90 feet below the ocean surface. This is even deeper than the Indian ruins we just talked about. 90 feet below the ocean surface, and it's composed of massive blocks of stone that were obviously cut and set in place by an ancient civilization. Just Google the thing. Yonaguni, Yonaguni. Just Google it. Look at, you know, do a Google image search. Tell me that's a natural structure. Nearby is also a clearly paved path. And all of this had to have been created, again, at least 10,000 years ago, which is when scientists say this area was last devoid of water, just like the Indian ruins, roughly 10,000 years ago. Isn't that interesting? By no means are these the only submarine ruins off of the Japanese coast. Another set is found about 30 miles west of Okinawa, near Aka Island. There at a depth of 30 meters lie several perfectly shaped stone circles the largest of which is over 450 feet in diameter. And the smallest ones are about 60 feet across. Stone circles.
Well, that's perfectly natural. It happens all the time. Stones are just set in perfect circles all by themselves. Kind of reminds me of what's said about a lot of the New England dolmens. Massive boulders perched high up on ledges, hanging over the edge, propped up on smaller pedestal stones.
Yeah, those are just glacial erratics.
Oh, shut up. They do the same thing on dry land, too, guys. They write things off that obviously were placed by human hands. By the way, those supporting pedestal stones are usually arranged equidistantly, you know. You can measure the distance between them. They formed either a circle or a square with these pedestal stones to prop the boulders up on. Yeah. Oh, those glaciers were really intelligent. Ridiculous. Just like, you know, a lot of the walls in New England obviously were not built in colonial times. They're ceremonial snake walls. You know, when the colonists first came here, they called it New England because the landscape looked so much like the land they came from, dotted with all of these ancient stone walls, stone piles, you know, cairns all over the place. Yes, the colonists built walls, but you can tell the difference once you familiarize yourself with them and you know what to look for. You know what the colonial walls are, and you know what the ancient walls are that were here before they came. And I'll tell you, most of the stone walls, when you're hiking out in the woods, most of them are not colonial. Most of them are ancient. They were here long before. They zigzag. They meander up and over cliff edges, for Christ's sakes. They're not boundary markers. They're not animal containment walls. Many of them are too low to be animal containment. And they wind and meander too much to be property. The colonial walls are straight with, you know, 90-degree angles. They're very clearly, distinctly discernible from the ancient snake walls. And by the way, the ancient walls usually encircle cairn fields. They mark the boundary line of the sacred ground of the cairn fields. Yeah. Again, when you've done this enough, you know what you're looking at. So I have to wonder, are these so-called experts who have made careers out of studying ancient ruins, are they that stupid? Do they not see what I can see? Half blind, and I can see this stuff more clearly than they can. Obviously, guys, they have to be lying to keep their jobs. I know a lot of them are. In fact, I was in touch with a local archaeologist who works for the state. And he told me that, he says, oh, yeah, clearly these huge boulders, you know, these dolmens, dolmens or else just perched boulders, you know, hanging over a ledge. Sometimes they don't have props. Sometimes they do. But nevertheless, he says, when you've seen enough of these and the configurations that they're in, straight lines, you know, 6 or 8 or 10 of them in a straight line, or forming circles or squares, you know, whatever. He says, obviously, they're not natural. They're not glacial erratics. But he says, I don't discuss this with most of my colleagues, you know, because they don't get it. So there's one exception to the rule. But he himself recognizes there's a lot of BS being taught in mainstream archaeology. He just ignores it. Imagine that. That's so pathetic. But that's how it is. Anyway, scattered throughout these features, these giant stone circles, are several 9-foot-tall menhirs, or standing stones. Exactly what you see on dry land. I see them all the time here in New England. Menhirs surrounded not only in close proximity with, but often surrounded by stone circles. In other words, you've got a stone circle flat on the ground with a menhir in the center, like a power circle. To them, it represented, you know, an area where, and you know, sometimes actually with magnetometers, they discover magnetic anomalies associated with these power circles. The ancients were attuned to magnetic disruptions in the Earth's magnetic field. How else can you explain that they would build them right over? A lot of the stone chambers in New England are built right over magnetic anomalies. In fact, there's one right near me in a town called Upton, the famous Upton Chamber. That's probably the most well-known of all the New England chambers, one that's been the most carefully, closely studied. And they actually found some charcoal that was dated to the 7th century. That doesn't mean it was built in the 7th century. It just means someone built a fire in it in the 7th century. It probably dates long before that. I would argue it definitely dates because they found some Ogham inscription right next to it, which would take us back to the Celtic copper trade that went on 3,000-4,000 years ago. Anyway, when you go to the back of this chamber, it's about 15 feet deep and 12 feet high when you get to the back. The ceiling for the entry hall is low. You have to duck. It's very narrow. It's kind of creepy because there's some massive, nasty-ass spiders crawling all over the damn place. I've taken a few girlfriends there over the years, and they don't want to go in. But anyway, I'm not crazy about the damn things either, but I'm not going to let that stop me from exploring an ancient structure. Anyway, when you get to the back of the hallway, it opens up into this huge beehive-shaped dome-roofed room. You know, it's a completely round room. Wait, what a piece of work. It's fascinating to take a flashlight in there and poke around. Very elaborate. The whole thing is covered over with dirt. It looks like a hill, a small mound, until you walk around one side and you see an opening. Oh, wow, look at that. So did they hollow out the hill and build the structure inside? Or did they build the structure and then bury it over? Who knows? But in any case, when you get to the back and it opens up into this room, if you stand in the very center, underneath the center of the dome, with a magnetometer, the thing goes off the charts. It's all over the place. As soon as you step outside that center, it normalizes. You get a normal reading. But when you step in the center, it goes haywire. You know, it jumps from 67 to 42 to 35. You know, it's just all over the place. As to what causes that, who knows, something deep underground. But in any case, they built this structure and made sure that the center of that back room lined up with this magnetic anomaly. That's not the only one like it. There's some up in Vermont that do this. There's some down in Connecticut. You can't write that off as chance. They were aware of these magnetic anomalies and perhaps made some practical use of them. Who knows? The Earth's magnetic field was much stronger in ancient times. Scientists admit that. It's losing strength every century, so many Gauss. So projecting back thousands of years ago, yeah, it would have been much more easily detectable then. And as to what practical use they made of it, or was it, you know, did it affect the mind in some way? That could be. Did it serve as some type of a place for a vision quest where the shaman would go, and because it put your mind perhaps in an altered state, it inspired, you know, visions? There's legends about this, that shamans would go into places like that and come out enlightened with a special message for the tribe. And that could be. I mean, it could be that the mind expanding aspect of that magnetic anomaly, kind of like smoking a joint, you know. I remember years ago, I used to play guitar all the time after I got high, you know, because it inspired me. It did. I would come up with these great ideas. I used to record myself playing, and sometimes the next day I'd forget what the hell I was doing. How did I do that? But I would come up with some great ideas. So, yeah, maybe, you know, they interpreted that as the spirits talking to them. But, you know, it was just the effects that magnetic anomaly probably had on the brain. Anyway, just the same way drugs can do, you know. Anyway, so here you have these great stone circles with menhirs associated with the, these other ruins off the coast of Japan. These are not natural structures. They're man-made. There's also some rectangular structures nearby that show signs of having been cut and shaped by human hands, not natural. About 50 miles north of this location, near Aguni Island, at a depth of about 30 feet, there lie a series of circular holes in submarine bedrock that look like well shafts cut into the rock. Their perimeters are lined with small blocks, and they're spaced at regular intervals, clearly indicating that they are of human origin once again. Less than a mile offshore from Chatan, at a depth of between 30 and 90 feet, lie an array of walls, battlements, and pyramid-shaped structures. Interestingly, there's a tale recorded in the Nihongi, one of Japan's most ancient texts, which describes how a deity named Hohodemi no Mikoto, the name that is, by the time you get done pronouncing that, it's time to go home after your religious services. Hohodemi no Mikoto. Mikoto. Okay. Anyway, it said that he climbed into an upended roof, upended waterproof basket, excuse me. Or, you know, could this be a submarine? An upended waterproof basket, a basket turned upside down, in other words, that you could use to go underwater with. And you wouldn't drown because there was air in it. It sounds like a submarine, guys, some equivalent of an ancient submarine. Anyway, it said that in this upended basket, he descended to the bottom of the sea. Was it called an upended basket just because it looked like a basket turned upside down? Was this some kind of an underwater device? If that's the case, this almost seems to imply that the ancients might have had an underground, an underwater city. So maybe it's not a city that was built on dry ground that later was inundated with water. Maybe it was a city built under the water. Who knows? You know, did they have scuba diving equipment that they could breathe underwater with? Or did they have it sealed off so it was, waterproof once you entered? Did it have some depressurization chamber or whatever? Who knows? Who knows, guys? You got to have an open mind. Anything's possible because we don't know. Nobody knows. Today's great scientists don't know jack diddle shit about what happened thousands of years ago. They want you to think they do. They don't. They don't. Anyway, while in this craft, says this legend, this inverted basket craft. He suddenly arrived at the palace of the sea god. This palace was provided with battlements and turrets and had, quote, stately towers. So there you go. An underground, or I should say an underwater city. It's estimated that these areas off Japan's coast have been underwater for at least 17,000 years. Again, you know, some of their dating is undoubtedly a little off, but it doesn't matter. All of these undersea ruins have been dated to at least 10,000 years ago, which takes us roughly to the time of what most catastrophists believe this global catastrophe had occurred. And as I said, I believe they were built shortly after this catastrophe. But, you know, check this out. This is not consistent at all with what mainstream science wants us to believe. Let's look to Egypt now. Egypt has its share of offshore deep sea ruins as well. Ashraf Bekai, an Egyptologist diver, said that, quote, "I have seen things underwater in Alexandria during the last 17 years that challenge all our knowledge of the history of this area." As an example, he went on to discuss how in 1984, he and some associates were exploring off the shore of Sidi Gaber, a district along Alexandria's crowded Karinchi, some 2.5 miles to the east of Kate Bay. Anyway, he said while doing so, quote, "We were about 2 kilometers from the shore, diving off of a small boat. I remember that the visibility underwater was exceptionally good. Usually in this area, the water is very murky." He happened to be there on a lucky day when visibility was very good. He said, "We hadn't been expecting that because there had been a storm a few days before, which moved around a lot of the sand and silt on the bottom. Suddenly, I saw hundreds of huge sandstone or limestone blocks laid out in 3 rows, each 2 courses high, and that they had been exposed on the seabed at a depth of about 6 or 8 meters, so as deep as 24 feet. The blocks appeared to be of identical dimensions, 4 meters wide by 4 meters long by 2 meters high. They were stacked up on an underwater ridge of some sort because there was deeper water between them and the shore. All around, there were hundreds of more blocks of similar size that were heavily eroded or damaged or had fallen out of line." A lot of these ruins show signs of having been washed over so much by waves in the past. They're so deep in the water now, there's no more waves. But in the past, they must have been close to the shoreline as the water level slowly rose. So that, you know, the waves beat on them so much, they smoothed them over. You realize how ancient these structures are? Anyway, he goes on to say, "This group of blocks had been seen on and off by fishermen and divers over the last 25 years, and there is still no proper explanation for it. I have never been so lucky with the visibility there again, nor the same bottom conditions, and despite many subsequent attempts to relocate the site, I have so far failed to do so." This was back before GPS, of course. If he had marked it, he wouldn't have to worry about visibility. He'd be able to go right to it. But anyway, You know, how many other sites are there like this around the world, guys? Why isn't there any? Well, it's obvious why. They don't want to find these things. Or if they do, they don't want you to know they're finding them. But there should be an effort to undertake a massive radar scan of the entire surface of all the world's oceans to look for stuff like this, you know, off of the coastlines of the world's continents. Jesus Christ, it's so pathetic. They don't do it. They don't want you to know. Makes me think of this diver off of the coast of Rio de Janeiro back in, I think it was 1976, back in the 70s anyway. He found some Roman amphora. He was so ecstatic about it. He's like, wow, wait till the world hears about this. I'm going to be famous. This is the discovery of the century. The Romans were here. And what, you know, what's so pathetic is scientists, if they didn't want to admit that there were voyagers here from the ancient past, they could just as easily have said,
well, they were here by accident. They must have been blown off course in a storm.
No, no, no. They're not even willing to do that. They don't want to admit the possibility that anyone ever could have come across the Atlantic and reached the Americas. So you know what the bastards did? They went to the site, sectioned it off, wouldn't allow anybody near it. They exhumed the entire structure, the whole ship, and carted it off. And nothing was ever heard about it again. They demonized this guy in the press. They laughed to scorn the guy. And that was the end of it. Jesus, goddamn Christ. It's unbelievable. He took them to a professor at Amherst University right here in Massachusetts. She dated them. You know, you can date sunken ships, you know, Roman ships, precisely by the amphora found on them. Different styles emerged like every 5 or 10 years or something, you know. And also, you can narrow it down from where the ship came from, what port it came from, too. Each port had its own brand or own type of amphora, even though the styles changed from, you know, at each port over time. You can still tell the time frame and the place that they were from. So she had them precisely dated. Of course, they said, oh, no, he found those someplace else over in the Mediterranean. And he said he's found them. What a bunch of bullshit. It's so disgusting. Something like that similar happened up in Maine. They found some amphora off the coast of Maine. And that whole thing was lied about and covered up. Just like the human footprints. In stone, fossil human footprints, guys. They've been found all over the world. They've been found in Russia. They've been found in China, all over the United States, Texas, most famously. Famous Flint Rose footprints. Whole series of tracks and it just lies.
Nope, that's not human.
Anyway, it's another break, guys. We'll be right back.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Segment here. Anyway, getting back to this Bakai guy, this explorer off the coast of Egypt. He then went on to describe some other ruins nearby, although he didn't see these ruins personally. They were just described to him by several credible sources, friends of his, acquaintances. And here's what he said about those. If you have lived in the wonderful city of Alexandria long enough and had connection with fishermen who do commercial net fishing, then you must have heard about Al-Kanessa. Some say that it is out in the open sea, about 1 kilometer to the north of Cape Bay, and that when an east wind blows and the waters are clear, you can sometimes see what look like the remains of a building underwater. Others claim that it is much further north, perhaps as much as 5 kilometers out from shore. 3 different people told me very specifically that it is indeed 5 kilometers north, north to northwest of Cape Bay. Anyway, before reaching it, the seabed slopes down to 40 meters, where the bottom is sandy with a few patches of rock. Then you pass an area of rocky pinnacles, some as much as 20 meters high, jutting out of another sandy bed. Then the bottom profile rises up sharply from 40 meters to just 18 meters in depth, creating a smooth-sided, flat-topped hill-like hill 5 kilometers from shore in the middle of nowhere. That is where they say the Kanessa is. Pretty sad. To my knowledge, nothing has been done since to confirm or to document in detail the existence of this particular set of ruins. And indeed, so many others like this that have been spotted over the years. Major excavations should be done again.
Oh, maybe they have been done by officialdom, but they're not going to tell you about it.
They're the modern Templars, ladies and gentlemen, where secretly they go and loot treasures from places like this and hide them away, and the public is never made privy to any of it. Disgusting bastards. Anyway, by the way, an update, I mentioned my mother wasn't doing too good. She's doing even worse, guys. Frickin' horrible, man. Absolutely horrible. I can't believe how much she's gone downhill in just the past couple weeks. God damn it. She's at a point now she can't even get up on her own. She needs someone constantly to be with her. Spending a lot of time with her, and I've got a neighbor that helps out when I can't be there. here, but all her life, she prays that piece of shit in the sky, and this is what that piece of shit does, huh? Yeah. Once again, guys, either the thing doesn't exist, it's a complete fairy tale, or if you want to insist he exists, okay, he does, and he's a prick. So take your pick. Take your pick. Either way, you got, dumbass written all over your face. Sucker written all over your face. Fool written all over your face. If you worship a thing like that. Actually, you got asshole written all over your face too, because if you emulate something like that, knowing what it is, you're an asshole. You must be the asshole that he is. The only way you can worship something like that and not be an asshole is to not know that he's an asshole. But if you've been shown the passages that clearly portray him as an asshole and you still worship that thing, you're an asshole. That's all there is to it. You can't explain this stuff away, sweep it under the rug. If you're a loving God, you don't do the things that that piece of shit does in that book. You understand? And you don't make promises, ask anything I will do, says Yahweh Jr.
Anything and I will do it.
And do nothing. Oh, how many times I've seen it over the years, guys. Yahweh worshipers who get shit kicked in their face. At what point do you get it? At what point do you realize you've been duped? This tribe has duped us about, you know, with everything else.
You think that's an exception?
That's what the Jew-wise Bible dupes, so-called Jew-wise Bible dupes, believe.
Yeah, well, they've lied to us about everything else, but not this.
Or then there's the other variety who claims that they're not the real Jews who are doing these things to us. But they are, who still follow the Bible. Oh, God damn it, man. Who needs epicac when you've got people like that walking around? Can you get more vomit-inducing than that? Anyway, though Bakai himself, as I said, didn't see this last particular set of ruins, so many others have that he's talked with over the years. It's obvious. Yeah, they're out there. Now that we have, you know, very good radar equipment, we can only hope that independent teams of scientists on their own dime are going to go out and explore these areas and confirm this stuff. Isn't it sad? The grant money will not support stuff like this, guys. So disgusting. And these are the people that most dumbasses look up to for answers to, questions about stuff like this, you know. Forget it. You're not going to get the truth from these guys. Even if they're sincere, you're still not going to get the truth from them because they read the same bullshit textbooks that everybody's getting bullshitted by. Anyway. Let's see here. Let's move on to the Persian Gulf. This is pretty interesting. The area of the Persian Gulf is believed to have been dry land. Guess how long ago? 11,000 to 15,000 years ago. 11,000. That would take us right to the time of, or just after the time of the catastrophe. In recent years, several scientific papers, such as one published in 2010 by the journal Current Anthropology, have talked about how this area was once a plush landmass that was most likely inhabited by a flourishing population.
They won't admit an advanced civilization because that wasn't possible 11,000 years ago, but
nevertheless, this article argues that there probably was, a large population of humans settled in this area at least 11,000 years ago when it was dry land. And lo and behold, as it turns out, recent satellite surveillance of the Gulf region reveals the presence of linear and rectangular features on the floor of this deep body of water. There's also a circular anomaly that has radiating spokes jutting outward from the center. What the hell could that be? Clearly, these represent remnants of an ancient civilization that once lived there, just after, again, the Great Flood. When this area was dry land. But even mainstream scientists are admitting that, yeah, it appears that there was life there. Not based on these photographs of linear features. No, just on the fact that they know it was dry land 10,000 years ago and it must have been a very plush area, blah, blah, blah. Looking to the Caribbean. And by the way, the Gulf of the Persian Gulf connects with the open sea, the open ocean. So, when that water level was lower, that meant that on a global scale, the ocean levels were lower, just like what all these other ruins we're looking at. These ruins are either open ocean or at least connected with the open ocean, so that in order for them to have been dry land at one time, the entire world's ocean levels had to have been low enough for that to be dry. You understand? This is grand scale flooding on a global scale that occurred to, inundate them like this. This has to be early post-flood, when all the waters from the flood had not been, not receded out to the ocean basins. And we know that happened, for example, where the hell is it now? Just east of the Grand Canyon is a huge plateau. I forget what they call it now. It's massive. And it's believed that it once housed a massive, massive, massive lake, if you will. A lake so big it really could be called a small sea. Anyway, it's believed that the Grand Canyon was formed at that time, shortly after the flood, within maybe a century or two, when a natural stone dam that had been holding that water in place burst, maybe due to an earthquake, the San Andreas Fault slipping or something. It cracked this natural wall that had been retaining that water. And then suddenly it just surged. And all of those trillions of gallons of water cut through the bedrock and created the Grand Canyon, probably in just a few weeks or months' time. Massive amounts of running water, folks, can do a tremendous amount of damage in a short time. It can move mountains, if there's enough, or cut a swath right through a mountain. With enough pressure, you can cut through steel. In fact, they have made saws. Did you ever see that? That's scary shit. A water saw that can cut through solid steel. And when it does it, it gives the smoothest cut you can imagine. There's no scouring lines like what you get from a saw. You can't tell that something was used to cut it. It's just so completely smooth. I remember I saw a video on it once. I've never heard anything about it again since, but they made a drill that's, ejects a jet of water so powerful, so concentrated, it cuts through steel. So at the time of the flood, yeah, or the, you know, the early post-flood, whatever, you had things like the Grand Canyon that were formed by massive amounts of rushing water. The canyon didn't take millions of goddamn years to form. It formed, guys, in a short period of time. That's even admitted, the Scablands in Washington, or at least one area of the Scablands, was witnessed to be formed back in the 1930s. There was a big local flood, and a huge area of land was cut out. Solid bedrock was excavated by the billions of tons in just a few days by massive amounts of rushing water from this flood. I guess a local river or something overflowed, and the water was gushing with such tremendous force, it just cut through. Now, you know, that's on a much smaller scale than the Grand Canyon, of course, but it doesn't matter. If a small local flood could produce that much damage cutting through solid rock, how much more so when you have 100,000, a million times as much water as that gushing all at once? Yeah, it would produce something like the Grand Canyon in a short period of time. The argument is,
we don't see things like that forming today, so it must not have happened in the past.
Oh, shut up. Again, guys, it's because they ignore the catastrophism factor, or want you to ignore it, that you fall for their bullshit, or that many people have fallen for their bullshit. Anyway, once again, you know, once you free yourself from that crap, from those preconceived bullshit notions, now your mind can soar, and now you can put things together for yourself without depending on them. And, oh, what a more fascinating picture emerges than the boring, dry, drab crap they present. Just like history, guys. History is so freaking boring. I don't understand how anybody could be interested in history the way it's presented. I really don't. It is so freaking boring. I hated it in high school. If somebody told me in high school that I was going to be a history major one day, I would have laughed at him because I couldn't freaking stand it. Bored the living Christ out of me. All they do is throw names, dates, and places, names, dates, and places after, you know, in your face, day after day after day. Who the hell wants to hear about that? Who gives a damn? It doesn't mean anything. It has no bearing. I used to wonder why they even teach it. Yeah, in the way they do, why do they teach it? Boring as hell. They don't make any connections with stuff going on. Well, most of them don't. Some teachers do, but you know, the system itself doesn't. The textbooks don't. And they certainly don't tell you the hidden hand behind the scenes, do they? Once you see that, my God, it comes to light. That's the only reason why I became a history major. And I didn't know about the tribal factor back then, but I at least knew about the New World Order. And so I was interested in the past couple centuries anyway, because I thought that's when the push for the thing began, you know, under Weishaupt. So I studied it because I wanted to know what else has gone on that we haven't been told. Little did I know, I was only scratching the surface at the time. But nevertheless, that's what fascinated me about history. Making the connections, the hidden hand of money behind the scenes, you know. They don't tell you any of this stuff. The most important things about history are completely left out. So disgusting. Every field does this, guys. Every field does it. So that if you carte blanche, accept what officialdom tells you, you will always be walking in the dark. Anyway, we only got a few more minutes left here, but I'll start another section. I might have time to finish this next section. The Caribbean. Quite a few things have been found in the Caribbean. The famous Bimini Wall, or Bimini Road, as far as most people are concerned, has been largely discredited as being of human origin. Yet, anyone who has ever viewed pictures of it can clearly see that it reeks of human design. It's a half-mile-long linear feature that runs northeast-southwest off the coast of Bimini Island in the Bahamas, and it's comprised of roughly rectangular limestone blocks. There's actually two other features, both parallel to the Bimini Wall, that lie between the shore and the main Bimini Wall itself. So there's three of these walls. Bimini Wall, Bimini Road, whatever. Anyway, the edges of the stones, which range from 2 to 9 feet in length, are rounded, giving them the appearance of loaves of bread. Again, guys, they might possibly have cut them that way. It might have been a unique construction style. Or it could be that they were squared off at one time, but as the sea levels rose, for a time, those things appeared on the shore. And so, you know, ocean waves beat on them over several centuries of time and smoothed them over. Being that they're limestone is softer than, you know, most other types of rock. So limestone would have been much more susceptible to being smoothed over by ocean waves. So that's not a big deal. It's very conceivable. Divers say that, you know, they haven't found any artifacts in the vicinity, so that tends to tell them that it's not man-made. Well, that doesn't mean a goddamn thing. If, in fact, these ruins once were near the shore and were beat upon over time, yeah, all artifacts would have been dredged up by receding waters with the undertow. And so therefore you won't see any artifacts. They were all, you know, carted off by ocean waves a long time ago. God friggin' damn it. Anyway, the main wall lies on average about 15 feet below the surface of the water. In some parts, the feature lies as much as 20 feet beneath the surface. Anyway, whether the Bimini Wall is man-made or not really doesn't matter, because there have been other candidates found in the region that appear to be man-made and occur in even deeper waters. And when I say appear, no, it's not. I have to change that. It's not appear. They definitely are man-made, as we're going to see. No question about it. They have found an entire city, ladies and gentlemen, buried beneath Caribbean waters. An entire city with satellite imagery. We'll get to that shortly. Or else Monday, actually. I don't think I'll get to it today, but. Anyway, here it is. Yeah, they found what they call a lost city located by a Canadian scientific research team just back in 2001. In a press release dated May 14th, 2001, Reuters of London informed the world that Soviet-born ocean engineer Polina Zelitsky, the president of the Canadian-based company Advanced Digital Communications, had detected, quote, a sunken city in deep waters off the west coast of Cuba. Guys, you have to Google this and see the pictures. It's jaw-dropping. It's massive. There are streets, buildings, you know, town squares. It's unbelievable. It's a huge city. Satellite integrated ocean bottom positioning systems, echo sounders, and high precision side scan double frequency sonar, said the article, have detected the presence of what are being described as shapes that, quote, resemble pyramids, roads, and buildings. Notice how they say resemble, because such things aren't supposed to exist deep beneath ocean waters. Um, Now, it says here, satellite integrated ocean bottom positioning, you know, blah, 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 echo sounding. Guys, they've actually taken pictures of it with satellite as well. Anyway, their regularity seems consistent with the idea that they represent an urban development composed of symmetrical architecture. Reuters further reported that the deep sea city is located on a huge land plateau lying in roughly 2,200 feet of water. Did you catch that? That's almost half a mile deep beneath the ocean surface. 2,200 feet. This is why it hasn't gotten much attention and why it never will, and why if it's been explored or ever will be explored, you're not going to hear about it, because such a thing can't exist. Or at least we can't allow the public to know about it, because it's not supposed to exist. We'd have to rewrite all the textbooks. We'd have to start telling them the truth that we've been bullshitting them, or that we don't really have all the answers. If nothing else, guys, pride. Oh, there's other sleazy reasons, too. But just simple pride. They can't admit they've been wrong, and indeed so very wrong for such a long time. Can't do it. So they're going to bullshit. They're going to sweep this under the rug. You can't sweep this one under the rug. Like I said, Google it. Ancient ruins off Cuban coast. Look at the pictures, goddammit. Just like the Reuters article said, symmetrical designs of structures, you know, deep beneath, 2,200 feet beneath the ocean surface. These have got to be the most profound ruins of this type ever discovered. Certainly the most profound that I know anything about. Holy goddamn. Do you realize how significant this is? You got to see the pictures, though. It's not enough to describe it in words. You have to see the pictures. Check them out. Anyway, that's it for now. We'll have more to say about these undersea ruins, these particular ones off the coast of Peru on Monday, guys. So have a great weekend. We'll see you then. Take care. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel all right when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many faces. Coming in out of the rain, they hear the jazz go down. Competition in other places. But the horns, they blowing that sound.
Kyle Hunt here, host of The Solar Storm, a radio show with lots of interesting guests, unique analysis, important topics, and essential inspiration. You will learn how our world got to this sorry state and how we can work together to fix it, starting down the road to a better future for us and future generations. I know it can seem hopeless sometimes, but the sleeping giant has awoken. Now things are getting interesting. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, right here on Renegade Broadcasting.